Campus FM presents a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grandmaster's Palace, entitled Some Paintings of the Palace, A Glimpse, The Portraits. This talk is delivered by Ms. Bernardine Scicluna and is organized by the Office of the President.
We are nearing the end of the tunnel. This is the penultimate lecture. The last one, as most of you know, is by Conrad Take about, of course, it's said to be what the Neapolitans say, dulcis in fundo, the architecture of the palace. But in any case, when, as you know, I am always on tenterhooks about these lectures, what will happen, what would not happen. And a week ago, I contacted Bernardine and told her what's in store. And she told me, because at first I thought that a glimpse, some paintings at the palace and the glimpse, I thought, what's this election going to be? Because if you pinpoint at some paintings and let go of others, but in any case, then I discovered what she actually meant, because she's focusing her talk this evening on the portraits. The portraits that are of kings, queens, presidents, grandmasters, of course, couldn't be otherwise. So it's quite an original lecture. In fact, she told me I would like to present my talk as a surprise. I think it is absolutely original, this evening's lecture about, she's going to talk about, now I'm exposing her secret, because she's going to talk about this particular type of paintings. So, good evening and thank you for coming. Bernardine Scicluna.
Good evening. First of all, I would like to thank Salvatore Musu for asking me to give this evening's lecture, which is dedicated to Joe and Miriam Scicluna, my parents. Secondly, I would like to thank you all for choosing to dedicate the next hour to listening to what I have to say about a number of paintings here at the palace. When Salvatore had approached me about a year ago to give today's lecture, I accepted immediately, but I admit with much blindness, because I had absolutely no idea what I was going to talk about, what theme or themes to tackle, hence the vagueness of the title. But fortunately, this evening I'm not in that same predicament, as I have in the meantime cooked up something, and I sincerely hope you will find the resulting visual recipe as mentally tasty and digestible as I have. So here goes. I'm going to walk you through a gallery of portraits that hang inside this palace, mostly focusing on the ones that are on public display, but also linking them with other portraits at Verdala and San Anton Palace, as well as a few at the National Museum of Fine Arts. Some famous portraits that aid in placing our portrait paintings in context, be it from an art historical, iconographical, social, anthropological, or theatrical perspective, will also come into the picture where relevant. I should tentatively start off with a very basic definition of a portrait painting. It is the representation of a person by a competent artist who succeeds in convincingly capturing the physical appearance, the physical likeness of that man or woman or boy or girl or group of persons. The person in the portrait is meant to be recognizable to its original and intended audience. Portraits are about specific people whose identities and not mere identifications they serve to establish and perpetuate. For many decades, up till around the late 18th century or early 19th, not just about anybody deserved to have his or her portrait painted. Such a privilege was restricted to those who occupied a high station in the social hierarchy and who, ideally, could afford to foot the bill of that capable artist who was commissioned to bring his patron to life in paint. And why have your portrait painted? The answer is to always be remembered while still alive, and most especially after death. For posterity, commemoration, for perpetuity, and for preservation. The magical ability of portraits to preserve the likeness of men and women after their deaths in the memory of those still alive had been propounded by one of the most important German artists of the 15th and 16th centuries, Albrecht Dürer. It was André Felibien who first attached the term portrait to signify exclusively the likeness and identity of human beings. Such likeness was forced to be authentic because it was the external appearance of the portrayed that had to be easily apprehended by others. The faithful pictorial imitation of reality became, especially from the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, an essential criterion of portrait painting. The aesthetics of portrait painting had to make way for naturalistic demands in order to translate into paint the person's physical appearance. Portraits were expected to be true to life and their subjects verifiable. Portrait paintings within a particular context, such as that as the palace we are in today, assume a particular dimension and fulfill a representative function. Collectively, they are a frank demonstration of power, hegemony, prestige, and commanded respect for the authority of the sitter. They confront viewers. They are always ready to be seen. They stand prepared to be looked at. So at the Presidential Palace, we have portraits of many of the Grand Masters of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem. These paintings dating mostly to the 17th and 18th centuries. Here we have Grand Master Lilladam on the left and Grandmaster Ferdinand von Hompesch on the right. Some of the French, Russian, German and Spanish monarchs, also dating to the same period. We have King Louis XIV on the left by Jean-François de Troyes and Catherine II, Empress of Russia by Dmitri Grigorovich Levitsky. We also have some members of the British aristocracy with Queen Alexandra on the left, painted by Edward Caruana Dingley, and Queen Victoria on the right by Georg Kobbewein, which is after the original by Franz Xavier Winter Halter. We have a few paintings of the British governors, with here we have Captain Sir Alexander Ball on the left and possibly Sir Hildebrand Oakes on the right. And, of course, last but not least, the presidents of Malta Republic, dating from the mid-20th century. The painting that has just disappeared represented the President Emeritus Dr. Ugo Mifsud Bonnici by Ray Pitre, and President Dr. George Abela by Natalia Tsarkova. It was the noble Sienese grandmaster, Zonda Dari, who incidentally was the nephew of Fabio Chigi, who was Inquisitor of Malta and later became Pope Alexander VII, who had commenced the collection of paintings at the palace. Many of the portraits, today arrayed in the corridors here at the palace, were originally hung in this dining room, and also at the auberges of the various langues and other buildings of the order. The palace's portrait paintings follow the typical conventions that prevailed in the times in which they were executed. Conventions of representation are ways of doing things that have over time gained social sanction. Conventions are a means by which to make and keep social order. They function to regularize and to regulate. Conventions are operative principles of order, just as order is the expression of power. Therefore, many of the conventions or the rules or the standards, in this case applied in portraiture, have stood the test of time and have for long been ingrained in the artistic and social subconscious to the extent that they are now taken for granted, if not considered universal in traditional official portraiture. The main protagonist, in our case, the Grand Master or the Governor, the King or the Queen or the President who is being painted, takes center stage and assumes the role of the main actor or the main actress. He or she poses in costume and inevitably requires an audience. Nothing and nobody stands in the way of the sitter, the term which is generally used to refer to the person whose resemblance is being captured in paint. Now, not all our sitters are represented as sitting. Most of them are standing and in full length. And there is a specific reason for that, because that was the pose reserved for the ruling classes. It was the pose that was expected for the portraits of princes and nobility and important heads of state. We have also a number of half-length portraits here in the palace in which the sitter remains standing, or in other cases they might be seated. Seated subjects such as heads, heroes and pagan divinities have a long history. And in pre-7th century classical statuary, the tendency was for females rather than males to be seated. Having said this, while the seated posture did not particularly carry any stigma, it was the standing posture that was the most effective to convey bravery, masculinity, steadfastness, and honor, as seen, for example, in Favre's portrait of Grandmaster de Valette. The brave Grandmaster emerges victorious in one of the most dramatic events of the order's history. He is the supreme, unconquered hero of the Great Siege, after the humiliating defeat of the Ottoman Turks under Suleiman the Magnificent, who for the penultimate time tried to obliterate the order from the Mediterranean. Favre's de Valette's standing stance may have its artistic ancestor in the figure of the same grandmaster in Matteo Perez d'Aleccio's fresco painting represented in this slide. And it is the scene which captures the battle on the 29th of July, 1565. According to Homer, falling heroes were compared to trees being felled. Bearing this in mind enforces the reason for Grandmaster de Valette's firm and proud standing stance on the battlefield. The standing posture alone portrayed the hero in all his glory. Eventually, sitting subjects, such as deities, began to increase as standing stances decreased. The first signs of the gradual abandonment of the old warrior ethos began to appear as gods and aristocrats reclined rather than sat at meals. This is because of influences from the East. This reclining custom also meant the devaluation of the posture of sitting. By no means, however, should the act of sitting, as seen in these portraits, be underestimated. We have Grandmaster Lascaris, Gregorio Carafa, the late Dr. Tabone, Grandmaster Vasconcelos, Grandmaster Jimenez, and Queen Victoria, represented in this slide, and they are all posing seated. This slide, for instance, represents portraits of VIP subjects. We have Pope Innocent X by Velázquez. We have a portrait of the ambassador to the Holy See, the Order of St. John's ambassador to the Holy See. We have a portrait of Queen Mary, Agostino Pallavicini by Van Dyck, Charles V by Tiziano, a Genovese nobleman, Van Dyck, and a portrait of Winston Churchill, all seated, just like our sitters here at the palace. And it's interesting to note that, well, they are seated on armchairs, but I'd like to say something about how important armchairs are. First of all, we have to keep in mind that armchairs were used to be few in number and intended only for the head of the household and very important people and heads of state, such as the ones represented. So armchairs were status indicators. We must not forget that persons of average or low class only sat on backless benches and stools up till the 17th century. The seated posture, after all, communicates the privilege, the luxury, the wealth, and the authority that the sitter enjoys. One cannot help also relating this posture to the ceremony of enthronement, in which the new monarch or religious leader is formally seated for the first time on his or her throne upon accession. The seated grandmasters, the seated presidents, and Queen Victoria, for example, gently invite deference or demand reverence in an intimidating manner. Another seated sovereign who merits distinct attention is King George VI, painted by Edward Caruana Dingley. He is seated on the medieval coronation throne known as St. Edward's Chair, after King Edward I, which since the late 13th century has been the throne on which British sovereigns have been made to sit as part of the coronation ritual in Westminster Abbey. Robed in sumptuous ceremonial attire, he carries the iconographical orb surmounted by a cross. Why? Because that is the symbol of himself as the defender of the faith and supreme governor of the Church of England. And in the other hand, he holds the scepter, which represents temporal authority of the monarch under the cross, just as his ancestor, Queen Elizabeth I, had done, and later on his daughter, Queen Elizabeth II. George VI's imposing frontality is as majestic as Emperor Napoleon's is bold and mighty in the painting by Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres of 1806. In coronation costume, Napoleon holds the scepter of Charlemagne and the hand of justice. This type of enthroned figure harks back in inspiration to the colossal statue of Zeus at Olympia. It was adopted for kings and queens, as it was for Christian saints. The portrait of King George VI is the only one whose seated posture is frontal, while those of the seated grandmasters and presidents is turned to a three-quarter view. The British king's ermine-lined velvet cloak flows and cascades abundantly and excessively in symbolic reference to the empire's expansive colonial rule. With the same extravagant profusion, the ermine-furred surcoats and cloaks of Queen Alexandra, Queen Victoria, and Queen Elizabeth II gush towards the foreground of the painting like an undulating sea of drapery. Besides affluence, these falling cloaks also symbolically convey the ubiquitous regime of the British Empire. The majority of the sitters' faces are frontal, directed towards us, even if their bodies or their figures are slightly turned in another direction, in a contrapposto manner. Virtually all of them seemingly establish direct eye contact with the spectator. These portraits represent the nobility, the elite, the monarchy, officialdom, and as was typical of European portraiture, they do not smile. They are not represented laughing, and exposing their teeth was unthinkable. Grinning broadly was for the images of the lower classes and the poor. The history of this difference lies in class prejudices, notions of class-specific dignity, beauty, as well as social and moral worth. The figures portrayed at the palace have in common their physical reserve, a kind of visual inaccessibility, a high seriousness and dignity, a stance still adopted in the photographic portraiture of statesmen, business leaders, and others of stature. One notes that politicians in the flesh are ready to grin considerably, but not when they are intent on projecting the conventional signs of statesmanship upon which the social prestige of their position highly depends. Some exceptions are present among our portraits, such as the turned gaze of King George IV, whose turned gaze suggests an element of haughty detachment and aloofness. Grandmaster Pinto, in Pierre Bernard's painting, King George III and Sir Anthony Marmor likewise look away from the spectator, increasing the psychological distance between the main protagonists and us, the insignificant plebs. Grandmaster Jean de Valette, on the other hand, has his head in profile. This is a detail from the Favre portrait, distinguishing him from the rest. This profile view conveys a dignified and hieratic air, reminiscent of classical antiquity. It should not be forgotten that Antoine Favre, the French 18th century artist who completed this portrait, was over 200 years Grandmaster de Valette's junior. The great siege map represented in this slide by Nelly has been included because of the portrait of Grandmaster de Valette, which appears as an inset. Let's take a closer look. Favre surely relied on two-dimensional sources, such as prints of de Valette's portraits, which themselves appear to have originated from standard coinage or medal portraiture. From time immemorial, the profile was considered to be the optimal view by which a person's facial features, and thus identity, could best be distinguished. Moreover, over time, the profile view came to carry dignity. Favre depicts the grandmaster's head in profile, while his body is frontal, if not confrontational. De Valette was, after all, the hero of the great siege. A Apart from the seated and standing sitters, there are two portraits that fall under the equestrian type, as the main actors here are on horseback. The motif of the equestrian ruler is prefigured in the journey of the three kings. Portraits of ruling classes were particularly candid demonstrations of the will to power. In this regard, equestrian portraits occupy a preeminent place in the portraiture of princes and rulers, as they were generally intended to awe the spectator into submission. Equestrian portraiture, and I quote from Mark A. McAuliffe's The Politics of Art, is political portraiture at its optimum. It bore a political message that extolled the triumph of the ruler's benevolence, as well as the manner of a ruler's administration of the state. Many rulers, in fact, preferred to be immortalized on horseback. But none of the Grand Masters, the British governors, and British royalty here at the palace are represented on horseback. The horse was considered a privilege, an attribute of nobility, and imperial power ever since antiquity. I quote from the same source, "A beast of immense resilience, it accurately reflects the aspirations of the political animal it carries." The horse represented the state. If the horse is well looked after by its capable owner or ruler, it will then serve its owner or ruler well. The dignity and the pride of the horse were associated with power and authority. As it was considered to be an animal of extraordinary beauty, the horse enhanced the image of the rider. The saddled and bridled horse symbolized the strength of the ruler, who securely held the reins of state. Equestrian portraiture emphasized virility, the intellectual strength of the rider, in this case the ruler, and the power of his leadership and awesome majesty. Undoubtedly, the source for future equestrian portraiture, the Marcus Aurelius bronze statue in Rome, was taken up in the Renaissance by Donatello, his Gattamelata monument, and Andrea del Verrocchio's Bartolomeo Colleoni monument, the last two dating to the 15th century. Tiziano's Charles V on horseback, obviously inspired by the Marcus Aurelius monument after Tiziano's visit to Rome, served as a prototype and proved to be of great influence. He painted the Catholic king victorious over the forces of Protestantism at the Battle of Mühlberg in 1548. Here is a powerful monarch in a heroic posture, but which cannot be further away from the truth, as Charles V suffered badly from gout. The demand for imposing equestrian portraits at the Spanish court in the 17th century was immense, such that Diego Velázquez painted a good stock of riderless steeds in advance to be on order, ridden by patrons seated in their saddles. The riders of the two paintings at the palace each hold a baton. Their proud horses exhibit agility, power, and loyalty, as seen in the other equestrian portraits by Velázquez, Count Duke of Olivares, the Tiziano that we've just looked at, and Anthony van Dyck's Charles V on horseback. Antonio Espinosa Rodriguez has identified the young rider, the bottom picture on the left, as King Carlos II of Spain, and attributed the painting to Juan Carreño de Miranda. De Miranda, after Velázquez, was the most important painter in Spain. This painting could have been a diplomatic gift from the Spanish royal court to the Grand Master, or commissioned for the Auberge de Castile et León, or that of Aragon. The sitter, is a very young boy on a pony. He is a warrior because he's got a sword and a ruler. He has a baton, hat, and riding outfit. His appearance and psychological stature are far removed from the character and stance of his real tender years. Imagine, he was crowned king by age 4. He is the last of the Spanish Habsburg line and the son of a rather perverse union, which was that between Philip IV of Spain and his own niece, Archduchess Maria Anya, daughter of Emperor Ferdinand III of Austria, who was 29 years his junior. In this portrait, he is around 10 years old. Unfortunately, in reality, this juvenile king was physically unhealthy and mentally ill. What do you expect? He was the offspring of unfortunate circumstances, conditioned by arranged and interfilial marriages that led to eventual degeneration. So this portrait is deceptive in that he is made to appear vigorous and in full control of his faculties, whereas his immature years, psychological instability and physical impairments were not the ingredients for kinghood. Such a portrait, like many others, reveals in the degree to which it simultaneously hides. It draws attention to the young boy's royalty, but distracts us from or makes us ignore the harsh truth. Indeed, representation is necessarily and always highly selective. Portraiture is indeed a fascinating subject, very, very intriguing, perhaps because it is essentially about other remote and recent past or still living human beings. We're all interested in each other, who in our imagination demand our undivided attention. As our eyes searchingly rest on what in reality is a verisimilitude, we slowly become aware of the infinite amount of visual intricacies that are at play and come to play on our perception of these main protagonists. This is obviously to the merit of the artist who has the daunting, sweat-breaking task of emulating in paint the facial features and physiognomy of no ordinary sitter, in a no-tolerance for negligible margin of error circumstance. Greater pressure would have been shouldered by the artist where the portrait sitting would have been a live one, unless the rapport between the grandmaster or monarch or president and the artist was a friendly one, as in the case here where Antoine Favre was a close friend of Grandmaster Derouane, represented in 2 portraits, and Grandmaster Jimenez. Tensions would have surely risen where the demands for the patron or the sitter on how his imago should be perceived were not compatible with the artistic principles that guided the artist's mind and hand. While the artist was bound to secure the likeness of the sitter, a certain amount of flattery had to also be on the tip of his brush, along with other colors from his palette. Any natural irregularities were toned down or suppressed by other qualities such as the character, the dignity, and grandeur of the sitter, an idea that developed in the late 15th century and was very much advocated later on by the German philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. A portrait painting, therefore, is far more complex than meets the optically functional eye. A portrait painting may essentially and primarily be synonymous with the representation of the face. But the fact is that the face forms part of the body of the sitter, who is either sitting or standing in a particular setting, which in itself acts as an extension of that represented person. It is in this setting that select elements peculiar to the sitter's social status, personal identity, achievements and decorations, and so on and so forth, are included. Returning to the sitter himself or herself, his or her figure would already be telling because of his or her body language. The face, for instance, is capable of conveying numerous expressions, just as much as the body can give shape to endless postures, poses, gestures, and gesticulations. To interpret and account for gesture is to unlock the whole social and cultural system of which it is a part. The study of gestures allows the historian to enter deeply into the functioning of society, its symbolic values, its ways of life, and its modes of thought. From the end of the 15th century, in the major artistic centers of Western Europe, natural movement observed from life was increasingly playing a role in lending vitality to artistic interpretation. The movements of everyday life were being absorbed into the expressive codes, into the expressive canon. Thus, idealizing tendencies slowly began to be shed as they limited the development of the narrative interpretation of gestures. We have to bear in mind, however, that the conventions of painting, manifested in formal composition, handling of color, light, space, figural pose, etc., sometimes have provided the opportunity to naturalize certain ways of seeing as though what is represented is the way things or people are, or ideally ought to be. Gestures are non-verbal communication. They are the predecessors of spoken language. They include any kind of bodily movement or posture, including the facial expression, which transmits a message. In portraiture, the pose and gestures would be deliberately intended and expressed according to some form of accepted code. Every attribute of the human body, size, shape, height, color, has a social meaning to convey. We may not be able to observe the bodies of the past in motion, but the sources, such as works of art, from which inferences can be made, are surprisingly rich. Gestures are an important ingredient in social differentiation and class. Bodily control exemplified internal harmony and the superiority of the mind over the body. Such composure and self-control can only be the result of edification, culture, and education that could be afforded only by those who were high in rank within the social hierarchy. So aristocratic and noble classes, as well as persons of a certain official stature, were expected to pose and be represented in their portraits, assuming comportments of equanimity, such as the actors and actresses portrayed in the paintings at the palace. Excessive gesture was inappropriate for such classes and tended to be synonymous with the lower ones in the medieval sense of the virtuous gestus versus the disparaging gesticulatio. I think you understand the point. Monks, canons, knights, merchants, and scholars made up different gestural communities in that they each belonged to different groups that reflected their place in the social hierarchy. Dignity and decorum were the opposite of laughing, shouting, dancing, and tumultuous behavior, as it was considered to be the loss of self-control, pazzia. In the early modern period, that is from around the 15th and 16th centuries, the suppression of gesture and the growth of bodily control were viewed as part of the civilizing process. This involved a strict curb on physical impulses. This reform of gesture is not necessarily part of a history of repression, but also a contribution to the art of living. This was due to the humanist rediscovery of classical ideals of deportment behavior, transmitted through Cicero and St. Ambrose, which underpinned the manuals of civility. From around the 12th century onwards, an interest in gestures was steadily growing and reaches great heights in and after the 15th century. Books on etiquette or comportment in the 16th and 17th centuries were largely aimed at those at court or on its fringes. The ambience of courts acted as the focal point for standards of behavior. Restraint and the elimination of large movements away from the body were emphasized. Hence the poses of the portraits here at the palace. The treatise L'arte dei cenni by the lawyer Giovanni Bonifacio, published in 1616, the famous Il Libro del Cortegiano by Baldassare Castiglione, published in 1528, which was also influential in England since Elizabethan times, and La Mimica degli Antichi by Andrea de Horio, published in 1832, were all part of this very long fascination for the body's movements and their meanings. The history of posture and gesture attracted the attention of scholars and artists. These treatises were intended for the nobility and the clergy to act as guides on how to adopt the modesty of movements and gestures, warning against frequent hand movements or walking quickly. So how legible, how intelligible are the poses and gestures in the portraits under discussion to us now? It's not possible to fully understand the behavioral code of the past, but some have survived the passage of time as well as nation. For example, to walk with the head erect still signifies authority, dignity, and detachment. To cower and cringe indicates abasement. To lower one's eyes remains a gesture of modesty and submission. Gravity and impassivity are evidence of self-control and are associated with rule and superiority. Obtrusive elbows are an assertion of territoriality and self-regard. Let's now elbow our way into this perhaps disregarded body part and the posture, the hand on hip or akimbo pose. The akimbo pose represented in these two paintings was a set piece gesture exclusive to aristocratic sitters. Certain gestures were and still are gender specific. Gestures that implied assertiveness were hardly associated with women, not to mention forbidden in the Renaissance. The gentler and humble sex would not be made to adopt this pose, as it was inappropriate. Female comportment called for restraint and modesty. It was inappropriate for a woman to stand with arms akimbo, as this was considered to be too aggressive and fitting only for males and Amazonian women rulers. I've included also this picture of the portrait of Queen Henrietta Maria by Anthony van Dyck in order to show you how this painting and many portraits by van Dyck practically became a prototype. They established the criteria for portrait painting, and you can immediately see the similarities between the van Dyck portrait and the portraits of Queen Alexandra and Queen Elizabeth II. The male elbow was a message of boldness, alertness, and control, at once protective, guarding, and controlling. Such a pose was typically associated with the male military figure, registering self-possession, the assertion of success or defiance. By the early 17th century, postures and movements lifted off from daily life had become the norm in art. For example, in the work of Caravaggio, and there's a detail here, and contemporary artists, we notice an explosion of male elbows, some of which even graze the picture plane. This is a far cry from the portraiture of about 100 years earlier, when arms and elbows were viewed as intrusive and too aggressive, even though hands had by then already begun to encroach into portraits. In his 1532 treatise on comportment, De Civilitate Morum Puerilium, Erasmus refers to the arm akimbo with denigration, as it carried a military significance. Giovanni della Casa in 1558, in his Il Galatea, condemns the arm akimbo posture as one of pride and boldness. In 1616, Bonifacio describes the arm akimbo as haughty and something to deride. In a nutshell, the arm akimbo was not befitting of an orator or a gentle person, as it communicated ostentation. The male portraits at the palace, in fact, do not exude the same type of bold effrontery and virile coarseness that is blatant in the paintings shown in the previous slides. While elbows at the Valletta Palace are evident, obviously, in these portraits, they do not brandish the picture plane or extend beyond it. We should take note of the fact that Grandmaster Hompesch and Grandmaster Pinto are in suits of armour, so they are military figures, and so, appropriately, they pose in arm akimbo. The German knight and prince Friedrich Landgrave of Hessen-Darmstadt poses in the same old warrior ethos spirit. The kings, too, adopt the same pose, but it is considerably softened by the overlying ermine fur and heavy dark cloak, especially in the case of King Edward VII and King George IV, respectively. In this slide, we have a lot of Alof de Wignacourt. These portraits show the typical military warrior portrait, which was a standard format used as early as the 16th century. Here we have the main subject standing alone, upright, alert, and resolute, oozing macho assertion. I've included the portrait of Pace Guarenti attributed to Veronese because it is an early work and it also acted as an important prototype. The Grand Master is the commander and authoritarian ruler of an independent military order. No room for pomp here. That is why many of the Grand Masters of the religious and military order, especially in the 17th century, stand in the calculated hip-shot stance and with a hint of an insolent look. The Wignacourt portraits at the National Museum of Fine Arts, which is the painting on the extreme right, and the palace, the one in the center, represent the Grand Master as dignified and assertive, fancying himself a mercenary soldier. The Louvre portrait at the bottom, which shows the same Grand Master as aloof, severe, detached, immobile, and remote, adopts exactly the same stance. The body language seen in these paintings should be read as self-possession, as the embodiment of authority. Typically, these are poses adopted by leaders with one arm outstretched, holding a baton, as in the case of these paintings, or in other cases, a scepter or a whip or a pommel of dagger or a sword, all displaying threat, power, and authority, while the other arm is akimbo. The weight would be on one leg in a hip-shot pose with the other leg casually extended. Similarly, Grandmaster Lilladam, Grandmaster Pinto, and Hompesch and Prince Frederick Landgrave of Hesse, who was captain general of the galleys, Mira Dispose. One would agree, however, that Grandmaster Pinto and Grandmaster Hompesch, even though they are dressed in armour, evoke an aura of royal grandeur. Their military role is considerably shed, allowing room for a more monarchical rather than a virile military stature. That feeling, too, is projected in the case of Grandmaster de Villena through the bronze monument attributed to Pietro Paolo Troisi. Talking of de Villena, his early 18th century portrait, in comparison with those of Lascaris, Vasconcelos and Caraffa, is in appearance and spirit quite different. The 17th century portraits reflect the sobriety that befitted the head of a religious order. De Villena is seated with a certain air of stateliness and self-assuredness reminiscent of a king. The predominantly bare and dark and austere atmosphere of the other 17th century grandmaster portraits is remote from any sense of regal splendor that is more evident in the 18th century works. The portraits of Grandmaster Nicholas Cotoner and Grandmaster Adrien de Vignacourt, predecessors of Grandmaster de Villena, are exceptions, but sure precursors to the ancien regime style of portraiture that the grandmasters in the 18th century became increasingly drawn to. To my knowledge, these are the only 17th century grandmaster portraits in which pages are present. This is also an exception to the rule, as pages tended to frequently inhabit the portraits of the 18th century grandmasters. The 1741 or 1743 portrait of Grandmaster Pinto by Pierre Bernard, which could be the earliest representation of the Portuguese grandmaster in Malta, in fact smacks of the features that were the visual ingredients for the portraiture of aristocracy. Seeing it side by side with the other portraits by Favre at the National Museum of Fine Arts, the one on the left, and that at St. John's Cathedral Museum, on the right, the grandiloquence of the Pinto portrait at the palace emerges in much sharper relief. It shows Grandmaster Pinto at a young age in a late 16th century Italian suit of armour. However, the wig, the profuse velvet and ermine fur are more characteristic of the 18th century in fashion and feeling. This portrait already spells of aspiration to royalty, despite the absence of the closed crown. Pinto's identity is consolidated by the large banner with the crescent moons. Even though he holds the baton of authority, as dictated by the iconography of his appearance in armour, it is not with military vigour, however, and conviction, that he bears it. His overall body language is in effect one that imparts affectedness rather than martial clout. In the Favre portrait at the National Museum of Fine Arts, the portrait on the left, which may have served as a model for the one at St. John's, Pinto's hand rests on a closed crown, while the other arm is open as an invitation towards the spectator. The august bearing of a proud prince best describes the Pinto in the 1747 portrait at St. John's Cathedral Museum. Here he points towards the closed crown, claiming sovereign status, as in his person, the order is declaring its absolute power and opulence over a minute principality. Why be surprised when, after all, Pinto was born to an aristocratic Portuguese family? Standing full length in full majestic robe in a vainglorious pose amid gilt furniture, flowing silk and brocades, Pinto is virtually immersed in the extravagance and splendor of the Grand Siècle. Portraits, like much of visual art, are about selective truths. The paradox is that the effort to produce visibility enhances invisibility. Art speaks of one thing, but remains silent on another. It draws attention to one issue by distraction from something else. In much the same way, the sumptuousness of this painting conceals the unhappy financial situation of the order and its inevitable bankruptcy at the time of the execution of this portrait. The very famous portrait of Louis XIV of France, at the bottom right by Hyacinthe Rigaud, has been included in this slide for comparison with the Pinto portrait at St. John's. This portrait painting of the French king is viewed as the classic and epitomizing symbol of 18th century absolutism. Here is a king in a full-bottomed wig, posing with hand on staff and the other propped on hip, a king who believed that his was a divine bestowed sovereignty. He is accompanied and surrounded by external trappings of a power based on dynastic tradition. There is not an inkling of doubt that the Favre and Bernard Pinto portraits have been executed in the same vein. For Pinto to have succeeded in closing the crown, thus establishing sovereignty over the Principality of Malta, no doubt required diplomatic aptitude. As the original deed of donation stated sovereignty as proscribed, this was basically contrary to the spirit in which Charles V, as Charles II of Sicily, donated the Maltese archipelago and Tripoli to the order back in 1529. It was up till Pinto's magistracy that his predecessors carried the open crown, implying submission to the Kingdom of Sicily. Pinto's adopting the closed crown for his coat of arms as the head of the order, soon after his election in 1741, established his status as the sovereign prince of Malta. Pinto belonged to a time when the seeds of the order's aristocratic propensities had finally sprouted and taken fruit. This tendency had been gradually taking shape ever since the late 16th century and reached a culmination in the 17th, fueled further by the flamboyance of the Baroque style introduced through the artistic figurehead of Mattia Preti in the mid-17th century. Derouan and Hompesch, and there are the two details included on the right, too point towards the closed crown, synonymous of royalty and absolutism. The Grand Masters hailed from great European families and were naturally eager to prove themselves. Their aristocratic predilection was inevitable. Moreover, on election, the Grand Master of the Order was the Supremo Superiore and immediately assumed the powers of Sovereign Prince of Malta. This role was expected to display nothing short of splendor, inspire admiration, and bear immense prestige in the dignified persona of the Grand Master. As the style of the Hospitaller government was arbitrary, the Grand Master began to assume autocratic qualities reminiscent of the absolute monarchs of the Ancien Régime. The manner of rule by the Grand Master had for long been brewing. Grandmasters had always commanded reverence and obedience. Therefore, Pinto's act of pointing towards the closed crown of royalty should in fact be seen as a logical culmination of a much longer process of evolution of this secular approach. Cardinal hats and ducal crowns had for long accompanied the arms of the grandmasters on currency, such as Grandmaster Verdal's coronet over his coat of arms, Grandmaster Lacassier's ducal crown laid on his catafalque, and let us not forget that De Villena was first and foremost a prince by birth and later on through office. His titles were Serene Highness and Eminence. So Pinto followed in his predecessor's footsteps that had paved and trodden the paths of glory and power in the past. This imperial paraphernalia, distinctly expressive of material wealth, luxury and abundance, is also seen to its extravagant best in this slide, where all the portraits, King Louis XV by Jean-Baptiste Van Loo, King Louis XVI by Antoine-François Caillet, Prince Carl Theodore, Duke of Bavaria, attributed to Pompeo Batoni, the Holy Roman Emperor and King of Bohemia and Hungary, Joseph I, King George IV, King Edward VII, Queen Alexandra, Queen Elizabeth II, are resplendent testimonies of pomp and circumstance. Props such as furniture, furnishings, military and aristocratic paraphernalia that carry a symbolic function serve to enhance the physical, social, and psychological identity of that grandmaster, king or queen in his official capacity. Portraits are inextricably the outcome of and tied to their compositions. The intended effect of a portrait is often revealed in its setting, which consists of the spatial environment by means of which the sitter sought to define his role in society and to tell the spectator something about his interests, his intentions and values. The sitter's identity is anchored in whatever and whoever is surrounding him or her. Backgrounds, whether landscapes that symbolize territoriality or seascapes that symbolize naval and maritime connections, or interiors that symbolize social status, acted as compositional devices consisting of several different elements that converted ideas into objects. The arm akimbo was often correlated with a view into the distance of a house, for example, or a battle, or the use of an elegant curtain, or pillars, or garden sculpture. So, for example, in the case of the detail from Grandmaster de Villena's portrait, which is at the top on the second, we have a detail of garden sculpture. Queen Victoria, we have a faded glimpse of the neo-Gothic Houses of Parliament. A detail from President Dr. George Abera, the crowded Piazza San George, including family and friends that are brought into sharper relief amongst the crowds. Frederick Landgrave of Hesse, bottom left, representing the fleet of the order, because he was the captain general of the galleys in the early 17th century and secured victory over the Turks off Tunis. A detail from Pinto, whose elbow directs us to the sky and somewhat agitated sea in the background. Is this setting symbolic of the Maltese Islands or the naval and maritime connections of the order? Possibly. Hompesh, whose arm akimbo leads us to the bold column, wrapped by a curtain. Now, the column represented power and grandeur. It was the mark of lasting majesty and stability and was an attribute of aristocracy ever since the Renaissance. In retrospect, this is a bit of a contradiction, knowing all too well that the German grandmaster was soon to breathe his last in his capacity as grandmaster of the order in Malta, because a few months into his magistracy, he was humiliatingly ousted out by Napoleon Bonaparte. Poses, gestures, and facial expressions alone are already infinitely broad in their variety and considerably condition the spectator's perception, let alone other significant elements in this vast visual vocabulary that need to be factored in, such as the sitter's robes, symbolic accessories, whether he or she is alone or accompanied, what the sitter holds or points towards. Adrien de Vignacourt, Pinto, Hompesh, Alof de Vignacour, Landgrave of Hesse, Lilladam, hold the baton of power. King Louis XV has his right hand resting solidly on the scepter of power. Attention to the closed crown, the George IV state diadem, is drawn by Queen Victoria. And Queen Elizabeth II, who holds the scepter with the Cullinan first diamond, added in 1905, also directs our attention to the closed crown. De Villena, President Abela, hold documents of office. Grandmaster Jimenez gestures rhetorically, and Empress Catherine II holds the sword entwined with olive leaves as a sign of peace. Vasconcelos threads the rosary beads in hand, reflecting the fact that the knights fundamentally constituted a religious order and were bound by religious vows. The emblems and attributes of these sitters cannot go unnoticed because they characterize them and expose their status and spheres of influence. These were part and parcel of the enhancement of a public image. Grandmaster Nicholas Cottener draws the viewer's attention to the system of fortifications that bear his name, the Cottener lines. Grandmaster de Villena, one of the most aristocratic gentlemen to rule Malta, bears the shield of the bears his own shield, and the coveted stoccado and pilier, the headdress, that is, the silver gilt sword and purple velvet, gold-embroidered helmet with the emblem of the Holy Spirit, which was bestowed on him by Pope Benedict XIII in 1725. The coats of arms on shields and military paraphernalia remind the viewer of the order's military role and duties. The Maltese flag and the presidential banner behind Dr. Guido De Marco establish his figurehead role and the identity of the country. Queen Elizabeth II's emblem is unmistakably clear on her coronation velvet cloak. Joseph I, Holy Roman Emperor, King of Bohemia and Hungary, points towards his bejeweled crown. Apart from the supporting emblems and props that cast more light on the main protagonists, the secondary figures in these portraits bear as much importance and presence to highlight aspects about the sitter. Favre momentarily freezes the significance of the siege victory for posterity, exactly in the spirit of John Evans' words in his book on the utility of paintings at the end of the 18th century. I quote, "A portrait is the best mean devised by the ingenuity of art to substantiate the fleeting form, to perpetuate the momentary existence. In a state of triumph and glory, Grandmaster de Valette wears a full-length suit of armor, clad with the surcoat bearing the traditional colors of the order, and holds, obviously, a commander's baton in one hand and the helmet in the other. The secondary figures are fallen comrades, and in the distance, the drifting smoke from the artillery sets the battle scene. The movements and attitudes of the human body played and still do a crucial role in social relationships. Gestures transmitted political and religious power. The portrait of Lilladam entering Imdina, also by Favre, captures a momentous event, that of the triumphal entry of the Grandmaster Lilladam into Imdina in November 1530. With reverence, he is presented with two symbolic keys of the city by the kneeling noble Paolo de Nassis, the prime jurat and senior municipal authority, second to the captain of the rod. Surrounded by knights and local dignitaries in period costume, Grandmaster Lilladam stands monumentally. His magnanimous stance is all the more enhanced by his black beretta, the four-pointed cap, and his black ceremonial cloak and silk gown with the prominent white eight-pointed cross. Like that of Grandmaster de Valette, the portrait of Grandmaster Lilladam is cast in the company of secondary figures that make up this visual narrative, which is the solemn entry into Mdina. Secondary figures in portraits can also take flesh in the form of pages. Those featuring in some of the portraits of the grand, those featuring in some of the portraits formed part of the Grand Master's sizable retinue, consisting of the Senescalco, who was the most senior palace official, the Premier Maître d'Hôtel, or the Grand Maestro di Sala, the Cavallerizzo Maggiore, Ricevitore, and other principal officials, physicians, chaplains, valets, valets, etc. They are, the pages, the secondary actors that buttress and magnify the significance of the main sitter. Through such an entourage of attendants, not only was the dignity and magnificence of the magistracy safeguarded, but it reflected an aristocratic lifestyle similar to that at court. These pages are represented as young, exquisitely dressed adolescents, usually between 12 and 15 years of age. Hailing from noble families, they were distinctive, sophisticated, and contributed in no mean way to the pageantry and stateliness of the magistracy. From the early 17th century to the late 18th, the number of pages grew from 8 to 16 and even to 24. Grandmaster de Paul, early 17th century grandmaster, for instance, appointed 2 pages, but later on, Grandmaster Piraeus had 8 times as much, that is, 16. So the Grandmaster's household evolved from a modest to a very elaborate one by the 17th century. When reading Schermerhorn's Malta of the Knights of 1929, one cannot help noting the rich clothing of the pages described in detail. I quote, "Winter coat of scarlet, lining is white serge, vests and trimmings are white velvet, summer coat is red wool lined with white taffeta, and the trimmings and vests are white moire. Stockings were plain white silk, and the hat was garnished with a white plume. Riding boots had straps on or buckles. They wore the eight-pointed cross of gold and white enamel." Now, doesn't this sound like the wardrobe contents of a juvenile prince? Indeed, these pages imparted as much of a patrician bearing as the grandmasters they attended. In these portraits of Grandmaster Nicholas Cotoner, Adrien de Vignacourt, and Manuel de Villena, besides their task to hold and point towards the Grandmaster's shield blazoned with his coat of arms or bearer sword, these pages fulfill a compositional function. On the portrait stage, they are positioned in a manner that enhances the centrality of the sitter, also in official importance. These elegantly dressed pages were apposite to complete the magisterial cast in this palatial theatre. The position of the page within the hierarchy of the order was indeed a privileged one. Only the sons of the most powerful aristocratic families in Europe were eligible to join the order as very young pages. Theirs was an unchallenged position within the magisterial household, which explains the air of self-confidence they tended to exhibit. In the case of the portrait of Grandmaster Jimenez, represented here in the middle at the bottom, he is unaccompanied. Seen among the other portraits, it is almost anomalous. The bare and unadorned setting, shorn of any opulence, pomp, and princely paraphernalia, reflects not only the parsimonious character of the Grandmaster, but also the economic austerity of his times, which culminated in the rebellion of the priests of 1775. During the magistracy of his predecessor, Pinto, the order's finances were already very poor, as there had been too much ceremony that imitated the sumptuous courts of Europe, leading to excessive spending. This portrait seems to be more about the signs of the times of the end of the 18th century, about the context in which the unpopular Grandmaster Jimenez lived. He sits weary and wary of the gradually fermenting enlightenment that later politically transformed the whole of Europe. The sobriety of this portrait may also be attributed to the fact that Favre, the author of this work, appears to have succumbed to the neoclassical trends that were pervading the visual arts. If it is neither pages nor attendants, it could be allegorical figures that enhance the portrait of the sitter. Such is the case of Gaetano Calleja's portrait of King George III, with allegories of Britannia and Melita. Both female and in suits of armor, these allegorical figures personify respectively the islands of Great Britain and Malta. They are overshadowed by the large figure of the king. George III here is hierarchically larger in proportion in comparison to Melita and Britannia, but lacks the feeling of power, force, and virility that many of the sitters we have seen exude. He appears somewhat sheepish and fragile, almost bordering onto the effeminate. His extended arm, which directs our attention to the allegories, serves to frame the distant seascape view of Fort St. Elmo, the ubiquitous heavy curtain, column, cushion, and closed crown, as expectedly make an appearance in this portrait of such a regal personage. By early 1799, the Maltese had expressed their desire to be under the English, as they had recognized in Great Britain a powerful protector and, more importantly, a useful ally in their attempt to be liberated of the French. In that same year, King Ferdinand IV of Naples was petitioned to accept the request of the Maltese to transfer Malta's sovereignty to His Britannic Majesty, King George III, who, in 1801, granted the Maltese full protection and the enjoyment of all their dearest rights, rights which they believed had been traditionally invested in the Consiglio Popolare and the Università. However, matters took a different direction when the terms of the Treaty of Amiens of 1802 were not honoured by the British, who instead decided to hold on to Malta for its naval interests and strategic position, as the outermost base in the Mediterranean, which could commercially link it with the Far East and North Africa. The Maltese were deprived of the popular sovereignty they craved for, and Malta was seized by the British as a sovereign colony. Is this why the stone profile of Fort St. Elmo forms part of the background? The 1814 Treaty of Paris downgraded Malta to a colonial status. Sent by George III, the small figure of Marshal Britannia, the emblem of British imperial power and unity, places her arm on Melita's shoulders in a befriending gesture. Such a warm reception may be reflected the guarded effort to maintain the Pax Britannica, since the Maltese were irate about the way political affairs ended up developing in the first two decades of the 19th century. In view of this, the fact that Britannia is equally sized as Melita bears much significance. Britannia is in her centurion's helmet, but her shield, trident, and lion are absent. Melita is like an Athena or a Minerva, in armor, with the shield of the colors of Malta, But here, perhaps, she is represented as the guardian of Maltese rights. The portraits at the palace are not only a physical, faithful likeness of the various sitters, but are principally portraits of actors cast in main parts, most of them posing in an artificial and highly pretentious manner or in a non-condescending formality. The portraits that we have seen are not necessarily candid captures. They are as composed as any narrative scheme. The decorum of ritual and daily life provides the background code of comportment from which the portrait painter drew. The introduction of purposeful gestures usually represent a distillation of generally accepted societal codes rising out of the collective experience and which convey an impression which the sitter is intent to give off, seen through the prism of the individual artist's aesthetic sensibilities. The sensitive artist observes and adopts nuances of non-verbal communication and adapts them for a pictorial system within which the sitter projects a desired impression. Paintings acquire meaning not only in relation to their internally specific contents and what people choose to say about those contents, but also in part according to where they are exhibited, that is, their physical site. So the portraits at the palace carry a particular significance, especially in the context of Malta's history. They were and still are principally tools of propaganda and primarily tools for managing culture, sometimes even forcefully. Some portraits once hung, and I say this because many movements of the works of art have over many decades taken place, and still do, and others still hang inside this palace, which in its infancy, that is as early as the 16th century, had already begun to manifest the seedlings of aristocratic court life. The Grand Master's propensity for ostentation was also evident from the interior decoration, the carpets, the damask, the silver, the tapestries, the furniture, etc., that over time converted the palace from a humble to a more elaborate venue. Furthermore, it increasingly lent itself to the many rituals conducted. Conducted by the Grand Master when dining, when entertaining, when hosting, as well as all the ceremonial functions with all their due pomp and panoply, tantamount to that of a royal palace on the continent. In this regard, the palace came to proclaim and boost magisterial prestige. In symbolic and metaphorical terms, it became the theatre in which the Grand Master and his attendants were the actors, whose audience were the exclusive guests and visitors to this staged space. We should therefore not at all be surprised by Patrick Bryden's description in the late 18th century of the Grand Master as more privileged than any prince on the continent. A military or soldierly style of life could not have been more removed from the truth, as Bryden observed, that majestic grandeur, social elegance, and all that was gentlemanly and fashionable in high society was gathered under one roof, this one. It is no wonder, then, that the portraits of the Grand Masters at the palace, or once at the palace, are in varying degrees visual displays of wealth, ceremony, and opulence, the appropriate backdrops to the theatre being staged inside and even outside in the urban surrounds of the palace. Just as opulent are the portraits of the various kings and queens contemporary with the order, and those that wore the British crown, when Malta was officially a fortress colony from 1814. The Prince of Wales Corridor aptly supports this portrait gallery of British royalty. Upon stepping into the Prince of Wales corridor, it is baptized so in memory of the visit in 1862 of the Prince of Wales before he was crowned King Edward VII. The portrait of George III acts as an introduction to the portraits of some of his royal descendants who reigned during Malta's time as a British possession. The dining room here at the palace is the last scene in this very long act. The portrait of Queen Elizabeth II as the living descendant of the British monarchy, as the head of the Commonwealth, of which Malta remained a part since its independence, as Queen of Malta, and thus head of state under the 1964 Constitution, draws the curtain onto the new scenario in Malta's national history, which since 1974 is enacted by the Presidents of Republic Malta, whose portraits hang in this dining room. Unlike their remote and recent ancestors in portraiture, the Presidents impart seriousness as their official capacity demands or demanded, but nowhere near the conceited kind. Ritual and extravagance do not really engulf their imago, indeed, starkly contrasted by the magnificence and regalia of empire reflected in the full-length portrait painting of Queen Elizabeth II. Unaccompanied, smart but plain in appearance, expressing a somewhat reserved body language, the portraits of the Presidents of Malta open yet another eventful chapter in the island's history. And in a playwright's script terms, the didascalies or the instructions of this final scene would open with "Exit Her Royal Highness, enter His Excellency." Thank you.
I think you are tired now, and I don't want to... Perhaps somebody would like to ask some question, but very brief, because I think you are more than tired
very
now.
Very sorry. This is typical. It's typical.
Now, what really surprised me is I have been all my life, I am over 70 years of age, reading and appreciative books, especially the most important books by Matteo Marangoni, and I assure Bernardine that what she has delivered this evening, it not only escaped my attention, but I have never met it in all my readings about art criticism and art appreciation. This is really, this evening, if there was a discovery, this is the most surprising discovery that has been in all these lectures.
You have just listened to a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grandmaster's Palace, entitled Some Paintings of the Palace, A Glimpse, The Portraits. This talk was delivered by Ms. Bernardine Scicluna and was organized by the Office of the President.